What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is David Ben-Dori, the controversial Gun Rabbi. We'll also have visits from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. I know that summer doesn't officially begin until June 21st, but in many parts of the country, summer actually starts with Memorial Day weekend. And as kids get out of school and temperatures rise, it begins to feel a whole lot like the season of sun and water and freedom. Or at least that's how I remember it from childhood, when the last day of public school signaled total release from responsibility. Oh, those blissful last days of school. I believe that in my memory, they were sometimes actually more pleasurable than the summer vacations that followed. It was the anticipation. You know, sometimes it's the idea of freedom that matters most, not the reality. For most working people, this summer period is not vacation at all, but there's a certain sense around an American synagogue, particularly among religious school families, that they are taking the summer off from Judaism and they'll see you again when school starts in the fall. I don't know at what point people began to feel that Judaism was a 9 or 10 month a year experience, but somehow that message has now been communicated pretty universally in congregational life, in nearly every Reforming Conservative congregation's life, I believe. And I know that there are definitely some families with whom I celebrated at the Siyum concluding ceremonies at our religious school that I will not see again until late August or even September. I don't know what to do about this exactly, and neither does anybody else in the shul business, so far as I know. It's not that we don't preach the message that Judaism is a year-round commitment, a way to experience holiness in life each day. And I don't think it's even a conscious decision people make to avoid religion when the weather warms up. It's just that somewhere along the way, American Jews learned or decided that religion, or at least Judaism, was a pediatric exercise, something to give to kids to make sure they got the right values and holidays and rituals, and hopefully married the right flavor of person, and that they themselves, the parents and even the grandparents, were exempt from actually experiencing the same things they required their own kids to do. That's why the very best supplemental religious schools in the world, and many of ours are very fine in America, can only do so much. Kids learn and know the prayers and holidays. They can chant from the Torah and sing about Israel and the festivals. They can celebrate their wonderful Jewish identity. But when the parents choose to just drop their kids off and split for a free morning and don't model any particularly Jewish behaviors or provide Jewish experiences regularly at home, it sends a very strong message. Religion is kid stuff. Grown-ups have more important things to do, like work out or go shopping, have dinner dates with friends, and volunteer for lots of other activities. It's not exactly what we rabbis preach, of course, but it certainly is a message that comes across loud and clear, especially in the summertime. Summertime equals no religious school, which equals no Judaism to speak of. And that's a shame. Because in truth, it's during the summer that we can really experience some of the very best parts of Jewish life, like the home celebration of Shabbat dinner and the opportunity to study Torah creatively in a more relaxed environment. When kids don't have to rush from chorus rehearsal to ballet to baseball practice to debate to student government to karate to homework, they can actually experience life at a more human pace. And if you take the time to have them shut off their video devices for a little while and have real family time, well, that can be time to explore their relationship to our magnificent tradition in meaningful ways. At our congregation, we celebrate Shabbat in the summer with our Chardonnay Shabbat services, wine and cheese and fruit at 5 o'clock, a one-hour Kabbalat Shabbat service at 5:45, and then go have Shabbat dinner with your family afterwards. It's a great way in the heat of summer to just chill and enjoy being Jewish. And you don't have to get up early on Sunday morning either. And so to play us in on this Sunday morning on Too Jewish, in the spirit of celebrating Shabbat in the season of summer and light, here's Danny Masseng's upbeat Vishamru, a covenant forever between God and the people of Israel to rejoice in the Sabbath. That was Danny Masseng's Vishamru from the Transcontinental Shabbat Anthology CD. You remember CDs before, you know, everything was an MP3. In honor of celebrating Shabbat every week, all year round. You know, guns and Jews seem like a bad match to many of us, at least outside of Israel. Most Jewish kids in America are raised with an emphasis on education, family, commitment to improving society, and becoming responsible adults. Learning to shoot a firearm just isn't high on the list of skills we insist that our children learn. I recall a wonderful interview that comedian and actor Billy Crystal had on a TV show once. He was promoting a new film in which he was playing a cop. He described how in the scene he was supposed to rush into the room holding a pistol, shout, "Police!" and then fire, bang, bang. Billy Crystal was kind of nervous about it all, but he did it. The director shouted, "Cut!" And Crystal felt very proud of his work, until the director said, "You know, Billy, that was great. Now this time, when you rush into the room, instead of just shouting bang bang, would you please pull the trigger on the gun?" As Crystal explained, "What do I know about guns? I'm Jewish. My father was a furrier. Throw the mink in the back of the Cadillac, Doris. Let's go home." Well, not all Jews are actually like this, now or ever, and certainly not in Israel, but even here in the States. Our controversial guest this morning is a very bright, very interesting guy named David Ben-Dori, an ordained Orthodox rabbi who works as a financial analyst and has taken it upon himself to train American Jews in firearms awareness and use. He calls himself the Gun Rabbi. Well, you don't want to miss him when we come back on Too Jewish in just a few moments.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. You know, the great Italian philosopher Antonio Garaducci once said, "To find balance in life is to find happiness." Now, I assume he was a smart guy being a philosopher and all. So it gets me to thinking, Balance is probably a good thing when it comes to pizza, too. You know, just the right amount of sauce, cheese, crust, and toppings. But consider this. What one mama's customer might think is just the right amount of something, another customer might think is too much or too little. That's why at Mama's, we balance every item we make to each individual customer's taste. Extra cheese or light cheese, heavy on the sauce or easy on the sauce, crispy crust or lightly done crust. It's all in balance for each customer. And as Gerarducci says, balance equals happiness, and that equals loyal Mama's customers. So I'd say that, on balance, that's a pretty good situation. Mama's Pizza with four convenient locations. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza!
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We're delighted to welcome the two Jewish our guests this morning, Rabbi David Ben-Dori. He's the Rabbinic Director of Jews for the Preservation of Firearms Ownership. Rabbi Ben-Dori has Orthodox Smicha, is a member of several Orthodox rabbinical organizations. He's the founder of Pidyon, an educational organization committed to spirituality, and a teacher of Kashrut as well. His day job, however, is as a financial analyst, which is where he receives his parnasa. He does not take money for his rabbinical work, but his reputation comes from his identification as the Gun Rabbi, a title he embraces. Ben-Dori is a certified NRIA instructor and range safety officer who offers practical instruction of firearm safety and shooting accompanied by the religious and ethical insights on personal defense that only an Orthodox rabbi can provide. He's also a leading figure on the website Jews for the Preservation of Firearms Ownership. Good morning and welcome.
Very nice to be here. Thank you for having me, Rabbi Kohan.
All right, this is, as you might expect, a rather unusual combination of skills, talents, and interests. Tell us a little bit about how you got there.
I think you just made the understatement of our interview.
Maybe.
It's kind of the path of my life, I guess, is how this has all come together. Though, frankly, there's more drawing this together than might appear at first glance. I came up with the Gun Rabbi moniker as what appears to be an oxymoron until you dig into the issues and you find that Torah law, Jewish law, advocates skills of personal defense. In our time, one of the best tools for personal defense is, of course, the handgun, which is kind of how that came together. There's, of course, a longer history behind that I'm happy to share with you of, you know, how it developed in my life and all of those sorts of things. But it's not quite the oxymoron it might sound at first glance.
You call yourself a Chozer B'Tshuva. You grew up Reform background, fairly assimilated. Tell us just about how did you end up coming to become observant? It was a gradual process, right?
It was a very long and gradual process, yes. My first real encounter with religious Jews came when I went to Israel at the age of just about 21. It was about a month before my 21st birthday. And to give an example of how assimilated I was, I didn't know that the temple in Jerusalem was anything different than the temple, you know, our Reformed temple. And I didn't know what the black boxes were when I went to visit the Western Wall or why they wanted me to put them on. So I had had very little exposure to traditional Judaism at all. One of my goals on that trip to Israel was to learn Hebrew. I was part of an ulpan, and we were adopted by families in Jerusalem. On the family preference form, I filled in exactly one item that I wanted on my family preference form. In order to learn Hebrew, I said, give me a family where no one speaks English. So if you know anything about Israel and you want to find a family where no one speaks English, where do you end up?
Orthodox family or a Sephardi family outside of Tel Aviv somewhere?
Well, very good. I ended up with an Iraqi family who lived in Jerusalem.
Yep.
Who were, I would call them traditional, as, you know, Sephardim, of course, don't have that Orthodox, conservative, Reform divide.
Right.
So there's more of a blur of observance. So I would call them traditional. Mm-hmm. But that was my first introduction to traditional Judaism. I came back from that trip to Israel, not at all religious, but very, very interested in remaining strongly engaged with Judaism, with Jewish culture, with Israel, with Zionism. And over time, my exploration of those different areas led me to a gradual transition in my own personal observance.
We will talk much more with Rabbi David Ben-Dori, find out how he became the gun rabbi when we come back on Too Jewish. Among my most pleasant and least time-consuming duties, I have the honor of serving as president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, which celebrates the memories of Rabbi Samuel S. and A. Irma Kohan, my grandparents. Once a year, the foundation gives a substantial cash award to an individual for outstanding service to Klal Yisrael, the total Jewish people. This service can involve any one of four different fields: unity, education and information, creative arts, or rescue. If you know anyone who might qualify for the 2012 Kohan Award, just visit our website, kohanaward.com, that's KOHON award.com, and you can find the nomination form there. And while you're there, you can also learn just who my own grandparents were and who participates in honoring their memory today. That's KOHONAWARD.com, KohanAward.com. It's a good visit and a great place to learn about a terrific award and all the recipients.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio, T-O-O Jewish Radio at yahoo.com, or visit our website at TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or downloading us from there at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. This week, our Jewish Poetry Slam comes as a retrospective on the Book of Ruth in the Bible, which we chanted last week on the holiday of Shavuot, Shavuos. It's from poet Marge Piercy, and it's called The Book of Ruth and Naomi. When you pick up the Tanakh and read the Book of Ruth, it's a shock how little it resembles memory. It's concerned with inheritance, lands, men's names, how women must wiggle and wobble to live. Yet women have kept it dear for the beloved elder who cherished Ruth, more friend than daughter. Daughters leave. Ruth brought even the baby she made with Boaz home as a gift. Where you go, I will go too. Your people shall be my people. I will be a Jew for you. For what is yours, I will love as I love you. O Naomi, my mother, my sister, my heart. Show me a woman who does not dream a double heart's twin, a sister of the mind in whose ear she can whisper, whose hair she can braid as her life twists its pleasure and pain and shame. At the season of the first fruits, we recall two travelers, co-conspirators, scavengers making do with leftovers and mill ends, whose friendship was stronger than fear, stronger than hunger, who walked together the road of shards, hands joined. That was Marge Piercy's beautiful poem, The Book of Ruth and Naomi. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbart, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Good morning, Guy.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
Boker Tov. We talked the last couple of weeks about teaching about Israel in America. Let's turn it around. Let's talk about the Israeli educational system, which I think most American Jews have no clue about. There's at least two major tracks, but there's other tracks. Can you give us a quick overview?
Yeah, the Israeli education system is a public education system. You don't have nearly, I don't want to say totally, but nearly you don't have private schools in Israel. All the, or most of the schools in Israel do give what here would be referred to as Jewish education. Of course, Hebrew is the common language. You learn to read and write in Hebrew. They also learn the Bible. Having that said, there are a portion of the education system that have more of an autonomy, which are more of what Israelis call the religion schools. And they have an autonomy to give more Jewish classes, more prayers and studies of the Torah She'Be'al Peh, the Gemara, the Talmud, and other
Mishnah,
stuff.
Mishnah, Gemara, the Talmud, the legal text, classic legal text of Judaism and law and lore. Okay.
Within that subgroup, there is a smaller subgroup who has even bigger autonomy, which are the Haredi schools.
The ultra-Orthodox schools.
The ultra-Orthodox schools. And with them, there is actually an ongoing debate because the Ministry of Education and the general approach said that all students from all versions of the school system should learn a bunch of core subjects. For example, math and English. In the Haredi school, some of them refuse to do that. And because the Haredi political parties have enough power, that is kind of let go. Okay, so the government closes the eye and say, okay, it's fine. And this is something very concerning because those kids grow up without some basic knowledge that is critical for them to be able to work, to be employed.
To find employment.
You can't do anything today in the modern world without any basic knowledge of English and math.
Right.
So that's one area. Another, you know,
and I should add, there's even a division among the Haredi schools between Sephardic and Ashkenazic tracks. There's separate Sephardic Orthodox, ultra-Orthodox schools, or separate Ashkenazic ultra-Orthodox schools, or some Hasidic ultra-Orthodox schools that are a little different still. It's really complicated, even within the Orthodox religious world.
That is true, and there are some very big challenges today in Israeli society, especially when we are looking at the fact that the Haredi, the ultra-Orthodox part of the community, have become significantly large. And while in the past...
They do have a lot of children.
Those are your words. While in the past, we used to... The secular Jews refer to themselves as the majority and refer to the ultra-Orthodox as a small minority. And okay, we can let them be and do whatever they want. It doesn't affect us. Today, this is no longer the case.
So what are the percentages like now in Israel?
I would say that about 15% of Israel population are Orthodox, out of which a third, which is about 5% of the total, are ultra-Orthodox.
Okay.
So that's about the percentage, but that's already a significant percentage. And if you're looking at the first graders, for example, then you will find that nearly 30% of first graders are ultra-Orthodox.
Well, Guy, we will talk much more and catch up on what actually so-called secular Israelis learn, but I bet they all learn Hebrew no matter what schools they attend when we talk next week. Thanks, Guy.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about French politics, largely because of the big French election that removed Nicolas Sarkozy as French president and elected François Hollande as the new socialist prime minister of France. What does this election signify?
All right. Well, first of all, let me make a disclaimer, which is I barely remember François Hollande. He was sort of a young, up-and-coming politician when I was working in France, and I may have met him once, but I didn't really know him. The guy who's widely rumored to be a likely prime minister, Jean-Marc Ayrault, was a mayor of a town I visited often, and I knew him much better, so I could make better predictions about him. However,
now, Hollande wasn't originally the guy that was likely to run, was he?
No, it was Dominique Strauss-Kahn, yeah, about whom we've talked on this show before,
and who
was
a
good, close, personal friend of
and
mine.
And got in a lot of trouble.
Yeah. Whether or not,
whether or not
deserved
it was warranted.
That trouble, right. Let's reserve judgment.
Absolutely.
But in any case, I don't think this socialist victory in France and the change of power from right to left will have as much impact on the Jews of France or Europe or Israel as it will on the rest of Europe and European politics in general, because this is likely to signal what will be misinterpreted as a domino effect. And things, similar things are likely to happen in other countries. But it's not because other Europeans are following the French example. It'll be interpreted that way, but that's just completely wrong. It is rather that other European populations are unhappy with their government's response to the current economic crisis. I shouldn't even say current. It's now a long-standing economic crisis. And the Europeans have basically reacted with austerity budgets and lots of cuts rather than stimuli and the combination of things that has been tried here with some moderate success. I mean, we haven't, not out of the slump yet, but we're not as deeply in for as long as it looks like the Europeans are going to be. And we don't have currencies that are failing, and we don't have widespread collapses.
Like Greece.
Right. And so I think there may be a wave of similar political changes across Europe from parties which have imposed austerity and which seem to their populations to have prolonged suffering, to parties which promise a stronger social safety net and more stimulus and an expansionary economy, even at the risk of some inflation. Not an economist, but I think that certainly the reason that Hollande, a relative unknown who's never even been a cabinet minister before, defeated Sarkozy so handily was that the French were unhappy with their economy. And that unhappiness is certainly not limited to France, nor is it as acute in France as it is in certain other European countries.
Should note that Hollande has made a number of overtures to both the Jewish community in France and to Israel, and when people were concerned that he would turn towards the Arabs or turn towards some policies that would be less supportive of the relationship.
There's no reason to assume any of that other than the usual sort of nail-biting tendency of Jews to say, ooh, this change could mean X, and sort of be fretful about any change from the status quo. I mean, sort of better the devil we know than the devil we don't. But I don't think François Hollande is a devil, and I certainly don't think that the French Socialist Party is the devil.
Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A rabbi, a priest, and a minister have their houses of worship side by side. Each congregation gets their clergyman a new car. A Buick for the minister, a Cadillac for the priest, and a Lincoln for the rabbi. But gas prices are going crazy, so they all decide to share the wealth in carpool. On the first day, the other two are shocked to see the pastor lay his hands on the hood of the Buick and prays silently. "What are you doing?" the priest asks. The pastor looks up. "I'm dedicating this car to the Lord's service." "Good idea. Be right back," the priest exclaims. He runs into the church. He comes out with a scepter and shakes water out of it onto the Cadillac. The rabbi stares. "What are you doing?" he says. "I'm consecrating my car with holy water," the priest replies. "Great idea," the rabbi says. He runs into the synagogue's tool shed, comes out with a hacksaw, and cuts 2 inches off the tailpipe of the Lincoln. That was the old Jewish Joke of the Week special featured to Jewish Just For You. You should live and be well. And you know, bris jokes really are the best. And now a word of Torah. This week, our portion, Baha'alotcha, from the Book of Numbers, is filled with a series of incidents and events from the wilderness days, as well as a couple of important commandments. It's in this week's portion that the instructions are given to create the first menorah, the seven-branched candelabrum that's become the most enduring symbol of Judaism. It's also here that we get the first rumblings of rebellion, which will explode into full-fledged revolt against Moses and Aaron in just a few more weeks, in the disastrous story of Korach. But most significant in this week's Sedra is a peculiar little story about gossip. Moses has married a new wife, and his brother and sister, Aaron and Miriam, don't think much of her. So they begin to talk about her and about Moses behind his back, circulating rumors and gossip. She isn't of the right ethnicity. They don't like her influence on Moses. She probably laughs inappropriately or wears her hair too long. The response by God is swift and decisive. Miriam, although oddly not Aaron, comes down with a dread ailment. Moses' siblings realize the error of their gossiping ways. They repent and are healed. But the point is made. Gossip and slander are among the most destructive influences in society. If we don't avoid them, we will indeed have tsoros, trouble, and heartache. If we can avoid them, we have every chance to build a society of holiness and good. It's a great message today. As the Talmud teaches us, gossip injures three people: the speaker, the listener, and the subject. It hurts the person who gossips, the one who listens to gossip, and the person who is gossiped about. All are morally damaged by the experience. No one benefits. Circulating rumors, sharing personal information about others, accurate or otherwise, is not the way to create genuine community or intimacy. Lashon hara, unethical use of speech, is attractive. It's kind of fun, but it's wrong and destructive. There are many other things we can talk about, and all of them are more valuable. A famous dictum says that great minds speak about ideas, smaller minds speak about events, and the smallest minds speak about others. May we learn from our portion of Baha'alotcha that the best way to use speech is to build and heal and learn, not to gossip. When we come back on To Jewish, our guest, the controversial Rabbi David Ben-Dori, will explain why he chose to become known as the Gun Rabbi. Find out when we return on To Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary from Rabbi Sam Kohan, newscasting from Israel.
For the first time that I can recall, Israeli newspapers and media are highlighting a story about progressive Judaism as the lead story. In a landmark decision last week by the Israeli Attorney General's office, Rabbi Miri Gold, a conservative rabbi from Kibbutz Gezer, right in the middle of Israel, will be recognized officially as a rabbi of a non-Orthodox community and will receive wages equal to those of her Orthodox counterparts. This decision follows a series of Israeli Supreme Court decisions supporting the reforming conservative movement rabbis in recent years, but the official move by the government marks a real substantive change in the status and professional prospects for all liberal rabbis in Israel. The decision, of course, sparked a firestorm of responses, both extremely positive and harshly critical, depending where you fall on the Jewish religious spectrum. The resolution of the Miri Gold case marked a huge victory for the reform movement's Israel Religious Action Center, the IRAC, and its head, Anat Hoffman, a former guest of Two Jewish, as well as for progressive rabbis throughout Israel and for the reforming conservative movements everywhere in the world. It's a tremendous shot in the arm for pluralistic Judaism in Israel, homeland of the Jewish world, and the second largest and fastest growing population of Jews anywhere. As reform rabbi Maya Leibovich said, liberal movements reflect the fact that Elu ve'elu divrei Elohim chayim, both Orthodox and Reform and Conservative Judaism, are the words of the living God of Israel. The importance of the decision is that it sets the model for relations between the non-Orthodox movements and the government, said Rabbi Gilad Kariv, the executive director of Israel's Reform Movement, Rabbi Gerald Skolnick, president of the Rabbinical Assembly, the conservative organization of rabbis in New York, called the Attorney General's decision a dramatic step forward in the struggle for religious pluralism in Israel. For the Orthodox leadership, especially the ultra-Orthodox political leadership within Israel, this is a huge setback, and they are fiercely angry. The chairman of the Habayit HaYehudi political party, member of Knesset Daniel Hershkovitz, who is also in the cabinet as science and technology minister, met with Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu and said, "It is not possible that decisions concerning the Jewish state should be given over to legal advisors and bureaucratic clerks. They are not able to decide who is fitting to bear a smicha, rabbinic qualification." Hershkovitz has no problem with the same legal advisors and clerks deciding that Orthodox rabbis qualify to receive state funding and titles, however. Other prominent Orthodox politicians were much less circumspect. United Torah Judaism's chairman, Yisrael Eichler, said, "Reform Jews have decreed upon themselves assimilation and destruction. Their offspring marry Gentiles, their sanctuaries are empty, their homes are deserted." Well, not my home, and certainly not my sanctuary. But the capper comment came from Shas member of Knesset Nissim Zev, who said, "The Israeli government has no authority to designate as rabbis people who falsify the Torah. This is the beginning of the destruction of the Jewish people in the land of Israel." Apparently, I didn't know I was supposed to be falsifying the Torah. I guess as a rabbi, I'm behind the times. Well, look, let's get some perspective on this and some clarity on what the real issues are. First, in Israel, unlike America, synagogues and rabbis are state-supported. That means that rabbis are employees of the government and religious institutions get tax money to function. Unlike the U.S., there's no big charitable deduction donation push to support temples. That's also how most churches and synagogues are funded in Europe, by the way. Second, while the Reform Movement has long advocated for a full separation of religion and state in Israel, as it is in the U.S., it doesn't work that way now. And until now, the government of Israel has supported only Orthodox institutions and Orthodox rabbis. That means that all Reform and conservative institutions and rabbis are paid for by donation, mostly from overseas. This imbalance makes it easy to provide Orthodox rabbis and schools for Israelis free of apparent charge, their taxes are already paid, but very costly and difficult to provide progressive or liberal Jewish rabbis and synagogues for an Israeli population that isn't terribly interested in being Orthodox. This unfairness and skewed field of play has made it extremely difficult for Reform Judaism to gain a foothold in Israel. Over the past 50 years, nonetheless, the Reform Movement, and to a lesser degree the Conservative Movement, grown slowly but steadily. While most Israelis don't attend the local Orthodox shul ever, an increasing number have begun to seek their spirituality in Reform and sometimes Conservative settings.
But it remains a small percentage of all those Israelis who view themselves as purely secular, chilonim, and who never attend temple at all. What this Miri Gold decision means for the progressive movement in Israel, Reform and conservative, by the way, are much closer to each other here in Israel than in the States, is that there will be more money and more official support for our movements here, which means that more Israelis will be able to find a form of Jewish expression that speaks to their needs today. It is hard to see how fewer Israelis saying they are not religious and attending Reform and conservative synagogues will be a bad thing by anyone's standards. In fact, it's a tremendously important and good decision. In other news, I keep wondering when the war crimes of Syrian President Bashar Assad and his brutal, torturing, child-killing regime are going to be addressed by the UN and the so-called international community. When you realize that most of the civilized world seems focused on Israel building housing units on land they've held for nearly half a century, while the neighboring Syrian forces under Assad were massacring 108 children, women, and men in Hula last week, bringing the total of slaughtered Syrian civilians in the past year to about 10,000 human beings. Well, makes you wonder what people are really concerned about, although many foreign embassies pulled their ambassadors from Syria in protest. Big deal. In other news, there was a tempest in a teapot when President Obama referred to Polish concentration camps while presenting a Presidential Medal of Freedom to Jan Karski, a Polish resistance hero during World War II. The Polish Prime Minister dubbed Obama's misstatement an outrage. What the president was actually doing was highlighting the courage and heroism of Karski. He inadvertently referred to Polish concentration camps rather than Nazi concentration camps in occupied Poland, the approved and correct formulation. The administration apologized, and frankly, the Poles should just get over it. And Israeli supermodel Bar Rafaeli was named the world's hottest woman by Maxim magazine. Other Jewish women on the list include number 3, actress Mila Kunis, number 14, actress Leah Michelle, and number 17, actress Scarlett Johansson. All beautiful women, their parents must be so proud. And that's the news of Jews around the world.
We welcome back to Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, Rabbi David Ben-Dori, the Rabbinic Director of Jews for the Preservation of Firearms Ownership. He has Orthodox Smicha, is a member of several Orthodox rabbinical organizations and unorthodox shul himself. He's the founder of Pidyon, an educational organization committed to spirituality. He teaches Kashrut for the Shema Yisrael Torah Network. His day job is as a financial analyst. He does not take compensation for his rabbinical work, but his reputation comes from his identification as the gun rabbi. Okay, so we've gotten you to an interest in Judaism in your personal history that led ultimately to adopting observance as a lifestyle and a commitment. Tell us how your interest in firearms evolved, where that comes from.
Well, my first encounter with firearms, interestingly enough, was on that same first trip to Israel. I was walking home one night and taking a shortcut through a back alley in Jerusalem, and suddenly there was a man running at me with, for what all I knew of firearms, which was very little, running at me with a machine gun. Now, in retrospect, it was obvious that this was just a soldier who had probably a 24-hour leave and was running home,
he was
you know, trying to get home as fast as he could.
Right.
Exactly, exactly. But at the time, I flattened myself against the wall. I was terrified. You know, I grew up with about as much knowledge of firearms as I had about Judaism, frankly. I first got curious about it on about firearms on subsequent trips to Israel, and of course got comfortable with the idea that firearms themselves were not violent. They don't cause violence. That in fact, obviously, in the right hands, they are tools of defense and protection and tools of goodness, if you will. The first time I held a gun was actually on a hike in Israel. We had a guard with us, and we went rappelling down a waterfall, and at the bottom there was about a 10-foot drop into the water. I happened to have had lifeguard training. I was treading water at the bottom just in case one of our campers fell. It was a group of college students we were taking. And when the soldier who was escorting us came down, he got to about 10 feet and for whatever reason didn't think it appropriate to make the final leap with his gun, so he tossed it to me. So there I am treading water. And, you know, in retrospect, I don't know what it was. It was probably probably a Galil, though I'm not sure about that. But at any rate, he literally tossed this rifle into my hands while I'm treading water. And, you know, imagine my surprise, as it were. But over time, I got more comfortable with the idea. I first thought that owning a gun, learning to use a gun, might be necessary for me following 9/11. Because 9/11, I was actually an eyewitness at 9/11. I worked across the street from the World Trade Center. And one of the messages that I took away was that the terrorism that Israel had been dealing with for years, that other Jewish communities around the world had been dealing with for years, was now coming home to the United States. And that we as a Jewish community need to be prepared for that and take whatever the appropriate measures are to protect ourselves from it. So I started to explore what might those measures be, and I started to explore what Jewish sources had to say about such ideas, about defensive measures in general, about firearms in particular as a tool of defense.
Fascinating. I would question that comment about guns as an aspect of goodness, but maybe you can explain what you mean by that.
Sure, and taken out of context, that could be a horrible comment, couldn't it?
Yeah.
Let me put it in context.
Maybe that'd be better.
If you use, for example, you know, a handgun in the hands of a woman who was attacked by a rapist, is in my mind a tool of goodness, because with that she can defend herself effectively and prevent that attack in a way that she may not be able to be effective without it. When I talk with people about possible means of self-defense, I point out that being a black belt in karate is a great tool of self-defense. You simply use your hands. You also are going to take at least a year of very serious training to get there, and along with, you know, constant, very rigorous practice and so on. But it is an equalizer that will allow a 125-pound woman to defend herself against a 200-pound man. On the other side, a handgun as a tool, you can learn to use very quickly. You can train for defensive use very effectively within a few weeks. And yes, you have to practice. You don't quite need to practice as rigorously as you do to maintain your skills as a black belt in karate. And it doesn't take as long to learn. So it's the great equalizer, if you will. And that handgun in the hands of the same 125-pound woman will be a very effective tool of defense. And as such, in that scenario that I described, a tool of goodness, if you will.
Tool of defense.
To protect the innocent.
The Talmud tells us if someone is coming to kill you, get up first and kill them. It's more complicated than that, of course, because they also have many statements about the sanctity of life and the preservation of life and make it extremely difficult to apply things like capital punishment. It's a complex mix. How do you wade through it, and how do you advocate for what you advocate?
Well, first, I'll point out, if you want to learn about this topic in detail, the first project I did with Jews for the Preservation of Firearms Ownership was called the Ten Commandments of Self-Defense. And in that, we look at 18 different Jewish sources. You just named one of them. And how really flesh them out with a lot of detail to understand how this all works itself out from a Jewish point of view. What I would comment on to that particular quote, if someone comes to kill you, strike him down first, is how I often translate it, is that that is one aspect of a love for life, and it's the same love for life that leads to the large hurdle of evidence in a capital crime, for example, before giving a capital punishment. That is to say, God has given me a gift of life. That gift is precious, and part of cherishing that gift is protecting it, and it's protecting the lives of the innocent, and under that framework that the Talmud makes the statement of, if someone comes to kill you, then strike him down first. The Talmud, in similar terms, talks about use of deadly force against an attack that's going to cause serious bodily harm. The same sort of vein, the Talmud compares the would-be rapist to a murderer. That's a serious enough bodily harm from the Talmud's point of view that deadly force is justified as a preventative measure. The Talmud, of course, and Jewish law subsequent to the Talmud, does not advocate the use of deadly force if it is not necessary. Now, of course, measuring when it is and isn't necessary is complex and scenario-dependent, but, for example, if you could get away without shooting, without firing a shot, from the Jewish point of view, that is obviously far better than killing your attacker. If you can wound prior to killing or instead of killing, that is obviously far better than killing your attacker. But at the end of the day, the Talmud says you have the right to defend an innocent life, and of course your own life being one of those innocent lives.
Is it a mitzvah to own a gun, in your view?
I wouldn't call it a mitzvah to own a gun. I think that's going a little bit too far. I would say it's a mitzvah to know how and be able to defend yourself and to have the necessary tools to do so. And that a firearm is one appropriate tool that you can use to do so. And from that point of view, one might try to stretch it to make the statement you just made that it's a mitzvah to own a gun. I wouldn't personally say that. What I would say is the following. It is my opinion that given Jewish history, given the history of violence against our people, I would say that given Jewish history, the history of violence against our people, that every Jew has a requirement to know how to use a gun, should learn how to shoot and handle a gun safely, and should take very seriously the question of whether or not he or she should own one for personal defense, and for that matter, for defense of the Jewish people. God forbid we should ever need it for such a thing.
You know, I recall when Meir Kahane moved to Israel, my dad said, you know, they have a Jewish defense league there. It's called the IDF, the Israel Defense Forces. Is this a bigger issue for Jews of the diaspora?
I think it is a bigger issue for Jews of the diaspora, yes. In Israel, they have the IDF, and they have the Shabak, and the various other anti-terror organizations. Look, here in the diaspora, we have here in the United States very, very good police and FBI and intelligence that are fighting against various terrorist organizations that, or for that matter, lone wolves, as they're called, who might try to do harm to Jews or to Jewish institutions. Having said that, the reality is that those government agencies that are charged with that protective duty cannot possibly protect us against everything. We had the JCC shooting in Seattle. We had the shooting at the Washington Holocaust Museum as two examples. And we could go down a long list, shootings at synagogues in L.A. We've had many plots disrupted, like the attempt to bomb synagogues in the Bronx. But unfortunately, the police can't always protect us and can't always be there. And as a community, we need to be prepared to protect ourselves if necessary.
Last question. What do you find more fulfillment from, the gun rabbi or Pidyon?
I think I find the most fulfillment from helping Jews to better understand what it means to be Jewish, helping them reconnect with their sources and traditions, and I do that in both contexts. It turns out that the gun rabbi gets a bit more attention, and so it gets a lot of people asking questions, and that leads them to ask questions about their connection to Judaism, which I consider to be a very positive development. Having said that, Pidyon, of course, gives me a much broader platform on which to teach a much wider variety of topics. And so from the point of view of breadth, that is, of course, more interesting to me. From the point of view of outreach and engagement with other Jews and getting them involved, I think the gun rabbi is a more interesting I don't want to call it an organization, more interesting aspect of my rabbinic work.
I want to thank Rabbi Dovi Ben-Dori for a very interesting visit here on Too Jewish. Where can people go to find out more?
To find out more information, you can go to my personal website, which is gunrabbi.com. You could go to Jews for the Preservation of Firearms Ownership, which is jpfo.org. You could, of course, visit Pidyon, which was the other organization I'm a part of that was mentioned here, and that's at pidyon.org, P-I-D-Y-O-N. And I'd love to hear from you.
Thanks very much. When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique,
Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be prominent British professor Bernard Wasserstein, author of On the Eve, The Jews of Europe Before the Second World War. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or from our TooJewishRadio.com website and like us on Facebook. Our playout this morning comes from a singer named Shirona, a lovely Shabbat Smira, a song for the Sabbath table called Ki Elecha. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week and a week, we pray, of peace.